With the 9th pick in the draft, the Jacksonville Jaguars select running back from Florida, Fred Taylor.
Dolphins showing blitz now. There it comes. Now back to throw. Turns and dumps it. It's Fred all alone. He's at the 30. He's at the 25. He's at the 20. On his feet inside at the 15. There he goes to the 10. Fred's on his feet to the 5. Touchdown, Jacksonville.
Where did this guy come from? You can't explain that. You cannot color commentate that. You can't play-by-play that. You can't tell somebody what I just saw. Holy smokes.
Now live from Everbank Field, 1010 XL 92.5 FM presents Jaguars Today with your hosts Mike Dempsey and Tony Smith.
All right, glad you're along on this Wednesday morning, brought to you by Metro Rooter. It is Jaguars Today kicking off here on 1010 XL 92.5 FM. Freddie T, oh, Tony, you ready to feel old? Fred Taylor's 40. Happy 40th, Freddie T. Oh, my goodness. I am so honestly honored to work with Fred Taylor on the postgame show on the Jaguar Radio Network for the last couple of years. It has been a blast to get to know Fred better than just when I covered him as a player in the National Football League and know him a little bit better as a guy. And, Tony, I've remarked on it many times. I've seen a lot of athletes approach their post-playing career by taking an eye towards the media in one capacity or another. And I've seen guys that just show up and feel like, hey, I'm so-and-so, that ought to be enough. And I see guys like Fred Taylor who, in this market with this fan base, that would be enough if Fred just showed up.
Yeah.
Fred doesn't just show up. Fred comes into this post-game scenario every game with a stack of detailed notes that he takes all throughout every Jaguar game, and it's amazing to watch him go through and talk to him and be educated by watching football through Fred Taylor's eyes. It's been a blast the last couple of years.
No, there's no doubt, and he comes in so prepared. He's got those pages and pages of notes from the game, and when a certain situation comes up, you can watch Fred flip through to find it, and basically whatever thoughts he had at that moment are still down on that piece of paper. So he's very organized, and like you said, we've watched a lot of guys that are trying to make that transition that aren't that kind of dedicated to what they're doing, and honestly, it's an hour. You know, Fred, this is for an hour of a post game. It's not that difficult to react to an NFL game, and Fred still takes it very seriously and is very good at what he's been doing with us for the last couple of years, and it has been cool to get to know the guy a little bit away from the locker room and away from the field, and the personality that you felt when he was in that locker room, he certainly still carries it with him. Fred's a really cool guy and one of the best ambassadors for this franchise that they've ever had, along with being one of the best players.
We get immune to it, right? We'll be going to San Francisco next week, and we'll see some of the who's who of the current and former greats of the National Football League, and with rare exception, you're like, all right, I mean, it's still cool, all right, there's Joe Montana, seen him, interviewed him,
sure,
several times, you know, you're not like, oh my goodness, that's Joe Montana, like, all right, there, you're recognizing some of the all-time greats are in the room. It is so fun, as J.P. Shadrick and I will be outside, inside gate one, doing pregame for home games, when Fred walks in through the gates, and he'll stop by and he'll say hi to us out there, and you'll hear his interview with JP every Sunday on the pregame show. But when you see Jaguar fans, when it dawns on them, wait a minute, that's Fred Taylor right there. Fred Taylor just walked up out of nowhere. What is he doing here? People lose their freaking minds.
Yeah.
And it's very cool to see, because Fred is a great, he's very approachable. Unless he's really busy. If Fred tells you, I got to be somewhere, he's really got to be somewhere. I see him pose for all the photographs. I see him sign all the autographs. And, even though it's a cool thing to hear, anybody, if that many people approach you constantly, oh man, I loved it when you ran that one this time. You think he hasn't heard it all hundreds of times? Of course he has, but he treats each guy or gal for that matter like he's hearing it the first time, because he knows it means a lot to them. So he's a cool dude.
Yeah,
is the bottom line.
And
happy
it feels
40th.
Like it's, you know, he's 40 years old today, and
oh, he's dirt old,
right? Like, but I wasn't covering the team, right? I was still basically a kid when Fred Taylor got drafted by the Jaguars, and I would come down for camp and do those kinds of things. And you form an opinion of Fred, the guy, based on just your 20 seconds watching him come in and out of the locker room.
Right, right? Sure.
And the idea that he's only signing 5 autographs, and it didn't matter if it was a kid that was waiting for the 6th one. So you form this idea of who Fred Taylor is based on those kinds of things. And then you meet him, you watch him grow up. You watch him learn a little bit from those kinds of experiences, and he's not the same dude. You know, it's not that same guy that you saw as a kid basically coming to Jacksonville. He's an adult now. He's a man. And like I said, he is a fantastic ambassador for the franchise of the Jacksonville Jaguars.
I'm with you on that one, man. And, you know, certainly brought some of the greatest highlights in the history of the team to the fore in that number 28 uniform of his. So today's fan feedback spotlight was an obvious one. What is your favorite memory of Fred Taylor in a Jaguar uniform? I'm sure we'll get a lot of the 90-yard run. We'll get a lot of trucking Mike Doss in an Indianapolis Colts uniform. We'll get a lot of the game against Pittsburgh where he ran for over 200 yards with 4 touchdowns and whatever else you want to throw in there. Share your favorite memories and maybe a personal interaction you had with Fred Taylor, whatever the case may be, at MD_1010XL on Twitter, at 1010XL Fat Tony, at 1010XL Tyler as well. We'll have the author of a book called Super Bowl 50, Celebrating 50 Years of America's Greatest Game. Bethany Bradshaw is going to join us later on in the program as well. And that book, a copy of that book, Tony, will become the first official item in the Super Bowl swag bag for 2016. This is Super Bowl 50. This is the greatest swag bag in the history of Super
Bowls. And last year's
was
pretty good. Very good.
It was pretty good. It's good every year, Tyler. But you will see that there are just crazy amounts of people walking around wanting to give us free stuff simply because we're in the media, because they think we might mention their product or service on whatever broadcast medium we happen to represent. And everyone who gives us something, we try to get 2 of, and we put a copy of everything we get in the swag bag. This has been a tradition the last 5 or 6 years or so, and we'll run our Super Bowl contest once again this year, which is, as a matter of fact, you can start submitting selections anytime you want. You have to email me, and only email me. I don't want them on Twitter. I don't want them on Facebook. I want them in one place, organized, and I want Super Bowl 50 in the title of the email. All right, something that I know what you're submitting, and basically you're picking the winner of the game, which team will win the game, and as is our tradition, making a prediction on something that will happen in the game. If you think Cam Newton's going to rush for 2 touchdowns, maybe that's your prediction. Carolina wins, Cam Newton rushes for 2 touchdowns. If he rushes for 2 touchdowns and Carolina wins, you go in the pile with all the correct entries, and then we determine, out of all the correct entries, which prediction was the least likely to come true that still came true. Obviously, if someone predicts Cam rushes for 1 touchdown and someone predicts he runs for 2 and he runs for 2, running for 2 is more difficult and thus less likely to occur. So that person would win in that particular example, and it's up to the judge's discretion. But you can start submitting those anytime, because I don't know how often we'll remember to plug that. Next week we'll be a little bit busy out in San Francisco, but between now and kickoff of Super Bowl 50, email Mike D at 1010XL.com your prediction on who wins the game, which team wins, and one thing that will occur during the course of the game. And I'll say this, don't be too specific, okay? I'll just say, if you say Greg Olsen will have 117 receiving yards, if you say at least, that gives you at least the over if you want to go that way. If you say he'll have exactly 117, yes, that you would probably win if he hits that number. Chances are you're not going to hit that number. So it's got to be something that's going to occur but not super likely to occur, if that makes sense. So you draw the line on where you make any prediction you want. If you want to predict Greg Olsen has 1,017 yards, I really don't care. But Super Bowl swag bag will include a copy of Super Bowl 50 celebrating 50 years of America's Greatest Game, and we'll speak with the author coming up a little bit later on. 641-1010 is the phone number. If you'd like to get on board today, we'll take your calls. You want to talk about memories of Freddie T. You want to talk about the Jags offseason. Dave Caldwell addressing the media yesterday at the Senior Bowl. We'll talk about his comments, and we'll catch up, as I said, with John Osher in a little over 20 minutes and get his reaction to what the Jags GM had to say in Mobile, Alabama yesterday as the Jaguars coaching staff on hand to get the South team prepared for this weekend's Senior Bowl. With Fat Tony, I'm Mike Dempsey. It is a Metro Rooter Wednesday. You're listening to Jaguars Today on 1010XL and 92.5 FM.
I'm trying to find the perfect words to say. I've been rattling my brains ever since they said we will hold this press conference and mention the Ring of Honor. I knew it would possibly come at some point, but this is special. I wasn't as prepared as I usually am, and I think it takes more than a couple days to want to be perfect and say the right things, but this is special. If I had gone somewhere else, been a young guy, irresponsible at times, those limelight possibly would have eaten me alive. Jacksonville is an area where it's not the fastest moving place in the world. And it gave me an opportunity to grow and develop and realize you can make certain mistakes, but you have to want to bounce back from those and move forward and be the best that you can be. And Jacksonville gave me that opportunity.
Freddie T, that was June 7th, 2012, the date he was inducted into the Pride of the Jaguars, Tony. And one thing that I like about Fred is, as you say, grew up, everyone recognized that Fred is a, you know, one of the great stories of, look at how this guy grew up as a person right in front of your eyes. You don't get a chance to observe someone's life like that in that particular way all that often. And for Fred, as he said there in his comments on being inducted into the Pride of the Jaguars, hey, I screwed up as a kid at times, but this city, this environment gave me a low-pressure place to kind of work my way through that. Maybe I wouldn't have lasted in the National Football League. He's always been honest about his own personal shortcomings. I loved the time he, I believe, first told the story on Pete Prisco's former radio show, where Fred went on and talked about his 234-yard performance against Pittsburgh and basically said, had I not gone out drinking so much the night before, I would have set the NFL record for rushing yardage in a game that day. He said, I was just winded, man, because I didn't take care of myself. And, you know, it's a regret that I have looking back. 234 yards and four touchdowns, Tony. He broke, at the time, O.J. Simpson's record against Pittsburgh Steelers, who had 227 yards in a game for the Buffalo Bills. Jim Brown was the only opposing player up until that point who had scored four touchdowns in Pittsburgh in a game. As far as I know, that still stands. It's just Jim Brown and Fred Taylor. Jim Brown always had an affinity for Fred, by the way. That was probably Fred's strongest thing that he had going for him in terms of national credibility, is that a guy who many considered the greatest running back, many considered the greatest player to ever play the game,
right,
always talked about Fred Taylor in the context of being the best in the National Football League or among the very best at any given time. Always put him up there. Even when Fred wasn't making Pro Bowls, Jim Brown recognized the natural talent. And, you know, that's a pretty, if you're going to have one guy recognize you and shout you out like that, that's a pretty good guy to have in your corner.
No, there's no doubt. And you go back to that 2000 season where he did that to the Pittsburgh Steelers. He started slow that year, missed the first three games of the season, came back week four for this Jaguars team. I'm looking at the numbers from that season right now, 57-24-54. Those were the first 3 weeks back for Fred Taylor against Indianapolis, Pittsburgh, and Baltimore that year. Pittsburgh and Baltimore, obviously, pretty fierce defenses in the league at that time. And then Fred just started ripping in 2000. The 234-yard game came in week 11 against the Pittsburgh Steelers. That was in the middle of a run of nine consecutive 100-yard games for Fred Taylor. He was unstoppable at that point that season. And it is funny talking to Fred and how honest and open he is about the stupid things he did. And I can't, as good as that game was against Pittsburgh, and I'm sure when fans stop him to take pictures, they're like, man, that game you had against Pittsburgh, I'll never forget that. And in Fred's own head, I'm sure he's thinking, yeah, that was awesome. And then the other thought is, what if I hadn't been drinking the
night
before?
What if I had 300, then no one would ever forget that.
Right. I mean, that would be something that's talked about constantly.
Would be considered one of the greatest games in NFL history.
Every time someone got to that 200-yard mark, they'd be shown a list of the most rushing yards in a game all time, and Fred Taylor would be on that list every single time. And he's an honest enough guy that he says, yeah, that was great. It could have been better. You know,
and that's on me for not.
Yeah, and that's all completely on him. But it was just an amazing run for Fred Taylor that year in 2000.
All right, so share your thoughts or your memories of Freddie T. Your favorite thing in a Jaguar uniform, your favorite memory you have of Fred Taylor in a Jaguar uniform, by tweeting us at MD_1010XL at 1010XL Fat Tony, or of course posting on the Jaguars Today Facebook page where you can stretch things out a little bit. Dave Caldwell, Jaguar General Manager in Mobile, with the rest of the Jags coaching contingent, by the way,
We'll talk with John Osier coming up in about 10 minutes live from Mobile. Tony, really talking up the defensive side of this draft, that there is a ton of quality there, which obviously lines up with the Jaguars' needs. And I don't think it's a coincidence in part. Look, they felt like they wanted to build the offense first, but as we talked about with Jeff Loggeman yesterday, Dave Caldwell's been a guy with foresight that looks ahead to the next draft class and the one after that. And we heard when he drafted Blake Bortles, he said, look, I looked at it and felt if he had come back and had another year of development in college, that going into last year's draft, he would have been the best pro prospect. That included, of course, Jameis Winston and Marcus Mariota coming out in that class. When he drafted Dante Fowler Jr. last year, not that it wasn't a need and you didn't need any explanation as to why he took him, but he said at the time, looking at next year, right now, we've only got one guy that has a first-round grade as a pass rusher in the entirety of the draft. And if you're looking for an impact guy,
sure,
you can't roll the dice that you're going to be the one team that's in position to get that guy.
And I think when you're looking at not only the whatever they thought was coming into the 2016 draft, but what they had available to them on their roster, too, and it's something we talked about a lot last offseason, and now you're seeing that kind of come to fruition here in this offseason. You got Clemens, who's probably gone here in Jacksonville. You have Andre Branch, who was coming into a contract year and hadn't shown you nearly enough for you to feel confident in giving him another contract here with the Jacksonville Jaguars. And again, played another pretty underwhelming season for Andre Branch, so you don't expect him to be back. There were a lot of reasons for them to be looking for a pass rusher at number three in the draft last year, and those reasons are still there for them to be looking at pass rush at number five this year. The question is, is there going to be anybody available to him that's worth the number five pick in the NFL draft? I don't know, but there may be guys that they're looking at this week at the Senior Bowl that are worth looking at in the second or third or fourth round that could potentially have an impact for them getting after the passer, which has to be priority number one for this football team this offseason.
Yeah, if you look, I'm just looking now. I'm trying to bring up Daniel Jeremiah's top 50 list, but I was looking at Tony Pauline's list on draftinsider.net of his defensive line rankings heading into Senior Bowl week. So this is prior to this week, how he ranks the pass rushers and the defensive tackles, separate categories for DNs and D tackles. But he has four first-round grades right now on pass rushers, and they're the guys that we've heard their names, you know, repeated over and over. Joey Bosa out of Ohio State, DeForest Buckner out of Oregon, Emmanuel Ogba out of Oklahoma State, and Shaq Lawson from Clemson. He's also got Kevin Dodd of Clemson listed as a second rounder. Kevin Dodd may have been having a phenomenal season prior to playing against Alabama's right tackle in the championship game, but that didn't hurt. Interestingly, just on talent, he grades Noah Spence out of Eastern Kentucky as a third rounder in this year's draft. A lot of hype about Spence. We've talked about him a good deal in the process. He is playing at the Senior Bowl on the South squad, so Gus Bradley and company will get a chance to coach him up close and personal and find out if what makes him tick. The story is, the reporting is, that he tested positive for ecstasy at Ohio State, got suspended, came back, and then tested positive again, and was eventually not only kicked out of Ohio State, but I believe banned from Big Ten play at the time. Went to Eastern Kentucky, and all you can tell, you can gather, is that he cleaned up that aspect of his life, went out and dominated a lower level of competition, which you should if you're a top prospect. So, you know, not set in stone that this guy is a first-round talent just waiting to slide to a playoff-type team because of the off-the-field issues.
No, I know the reports earlier in the week are that teams have been impressed when having an opportunity to sit down and talk to Noah Spence about whatever went on and trying to handle that situation, because there's scouts from all 32 teams, obviously, at the Senior Bowl getting opportunities to sit down with some of these players. Jaguars get the opportunity to get their hands on these guys and coach them up a little bit, which is the extra opportunity that they get having been now coaching the game for the third year in a row. But Noah Spence, you know, they do all the weighing in and measuring yesterday, and he'll do it again when he gets to the combine. But there were some eyebrows raised for whatever it's worth. His arms are short. I don't know how that's going to affect him throughout this entire process, but apparently his arms were shorter than they would like to see, that wingspan is affected by that, obviously. It looks like he may be more of a stand-up outside linebacker than a real traditional 4-3 end, but he's clearly a pass rusher. I mean, That's what Noah Spence is. He's going to be a guy that's brought into the league to rush the passer, and there have been undersized, quote, guys that have been really effective at rushing the passer in the National Football League. So I don't know how much any of that scares me off of Spence, but it is interesting to hear somebody say that they feel like he's a third-round player because he's being talked about like a first-round talent by everybody else right now.
Right. I mean, Dan Brugler would have you believe he might be a top 10, top 15 type talent just on talent alone, not factoring in the off-the-field stuff. But I find Jeremiah's rankings, by the way, the pass rushers that he has listed as first-round talents. This is not a mock draft. This is just his top 50 list. He had Joey Bosa at number 4 out of Ohio State, number 4 overall. DeForest Buckner out of Oregon at number 5. I believe, if I'm not missing anybody here, you go down to number 22, where we talked about Kevin Dodd a moment ago out of Clemson, and he has got Dodd as his third-ranked defensive end slash pass rusher, a couple of spots ahead of his teammate Shaq Lawson. Going through the rest of the first, what would be first round, he's got Noah Spence at 31. So he does grade him as a first round talent. And the thought with a guy like that is, A, you're going to learn a lot about him throughout the course of the week if you're the South coaching squad. And if you determine he's, you know, that kind of player, maybe you'll be in position to draft him, but at least you'll have had as much intelligence on this guy as possible if any team entertains a trade up into the end of the first round for a guy like this. If his draft process goes very well, you could see that maybe playing out. Oh, who knows? Maybe he will end up being more of a consensus third-round talent. The Jags at least should have as much information on him as any team in the National Football League trying to assess draft-eligible players. 641-1010 if you want to get in. We'll talk with John Osier coming up next. He's live in Mobile. We'll find out what O knows about what's going on with the Senior Bowl this week. Apparently, weather delaying practice a little bit today. Some inclement weather in Mobile. But we'll get the latest from what Johnny picked up yesterday, listening to Dave Caldwell speak, among other things. It's Jaguars Today. Wednesday's brought to you by our friends at Metro Rooter for all size plumbing jobs, residential, commercial, industrial, septic systems, restaurant, grease trap service, you name it. If it has to do with plumbing, Metro Rooter has a solution. Same day service, weekends included, because they have the right people with the right equipment getting the job done right the first time. Serving Jacksonville and the surrounding area since 1978. That's Metro Rooter. Visit them at MetroRooter.com or call 695-1911. That's 695-1911 for Metro Rooter, our Wednesday sponsor here on Jaguars Today. Back with more, including John Osier, straight ahead on 1010XL and 92.5 FM.
It's time for O Knows with Jaguars.com's John Osher.
O Knows.
Presented by Florida Pump Service on Jaguars Today.
Johnny O knows what's going on with the Jacksonville Jaguars. He is in Mobile right now with the Gus Bradley and staff as they coach him up on the South squad for Senior Bowl, whatever it would be. I don't know how many Senior Bowls they've played, Tony, but a bunch of them that's coming up this Saturday afternoon.
Didn't they just release their, like, 50th anniversary team?
Is that right?
I think so.
Go look at that one. Were the guys talking about that yesterday on primetime? I know they were talking about something about
I heard it on the drill yesterday morning briefly.
I'd be curious to look at that 50th anniversary team. Let's talk to John Osier of Jaguars.com, a senior writer, first up today. Good morning, John. How are you, sir?
Hello, how are you?
We're good. Today is a happy, fabulous 40th birthday for one Fred Taylor, certainly one of the iconic figures of this franchise. It makes you feel a little bit old, doesn't it, right?
Yeah,
Freddie
it does.
40.
Yeah, I can remember. I was doing the All-State team in high school and when Fred was in high school. So, and they covered him in Florida. So, I feel like I've known him most of his life with, I guess I know.
Yeah, more than 50% of it now, right?
Yeah.
It's pretty crazy, John. And Fred's left with so many great memories. And Tony and I were talking about, you know, how privileged we feel to get to know Fred a little bit better working with the Jaguar Radio Network over the last couple of years. He's a great guy, in addition to being a phenomenal player in this franchise's history. If there's one moment or game or performance that stands out to you from Fred Taylor's career in Jacksonville, what would that be?
Well, I covered him, remember, the first 3 years, 98 to 2000, which I was fortunate enough that was, I would say it was his best stretch because he was obviously great after that, but a lot of the memories are from there. you know, the obvious choice is the 90-yarder against Miami, and then there was the first play against, I believe it was Tennessee or Baltimore. And he caught the 70-yard pass against Baltimore where he basically went deep on the Ravens. But I think the one that stands out, and maybe I'm deferring to him a little bit, I know his favorite, the one he talks about, was the 78-yarder against Tampa. I think it was 78 yards in that great game at Altel where, you know, he was going back and forth with Warren Sapp and Redell Anthony, who he knew, and they ran a draw play late in the game, and he went, I think it was 78 yards, kind of capped that game. You know, one of the greatest games at Everbank Field, probably ever for the Jaguars, and one not a lot of people talk about sometimes. But I know from talking to him, that's certainly one that stands out for him. He was a rookie just coming into his own, just sort of proving to himself that he was as good as everybody thought he was. So those are always special. But the interesting thing about Fred, the 2000 season, the last one I covered him, was that year that he reeled off 9 straight 100-yard games. He was hurt early. And I think he had 9 straight 100-yard games. And I've never seen a back consistently break spectacular long runs the way he did during that stretch. That was a stretch where there was the Pittsburgh game that he set the record up there. But that really wasn't the only one. I mean, he was phenomenal that season. And, you know, I think, as you said, the thing about Fred, anybody who gets to know him, I think sometimes when Jaguars fans first meet him, they're like, wow, I'm meeting Fred Taylor. And after you get to know him, you realize he's just a humble, really, really good person to be around. So I'm a big Fred fan.
John, you had the opportunity, like you said, to meet Fred when he was still in high school. You obviously covered him early in his career here in Jacksonville. You've gotten to know him over the years. We all have gotten to know him here recently doing the Jaguars broadcast with what he's doing on postgame, and getting Fred back in the building has been nothing less than awesome. But just talk about the maturation process for Fred as a young player coming into the league, and when you felt like it really clicked for him as far as what he needed to do to be able to sustain some of the success that his athleticism allowed him to have early on.
Yeah, you know, I actually first met him when he was at Florida as a freshman. You don't really get to know the guys too well when you're covering college, because it's not like you go into the locker room and talk to them the way you can when you're covering the NFL. So, you know, I think I saw him start to mature a little bit my last year, which was 2000, the year I was talking about. From talking to him, I think he would tell you that it sort of happened gradually after that, that he really grew up a lot every year. And, you know, I think that's what was neat for me to see. I left, of course, 01, came back and, you know, sort of got to know him again in 2011 and 12 when he retired, was back around a lot. And I was obviously struck by, you know, what an impressive guy he had become, you know, and I guess sort of comfortable in his own skin. And but he was always, you know, I know he has said he had to grow up a lot, but frankly, even when he was a rookie second year, if you took the time to get to know him and I talked to him, he's always been this humble guy inside. I mean, I'm sure he grew up the way a lot of us do, but I never thought of Fred, even when he was a rookie or a second year player, as a guy who needed to change a whole lot to be a successful person. I mean, he was always a solid kid to me.
Well, look, he turns 40 today, quite accomplished, pride of the Jaguars, all that. And, you know, I don't know if he'll ever get any serious Hall of Fame consideration because, you know, it's a numbers game. So many guys in his era that put up big numbers as well. But one of the things Tony and I remarked about, Jim Brown always considered him, if not the best, one of the handful of best in the game. That's a pretty good guy to have in your corner when it comes to assessing running back talent. Osier here. Yeah, John Osier here with us live in Mobile. So what's new, Johnny? What did you pick up yesterday? Dave Caldwell certainly meeting with you guys in Mobile, but I don't think, you know, for most close observers of the Jags, there was a whole lot of surprise in what he had to say. Did anything catch you or catch particular interest for you?
Yeah, not really. I mean, you know, if you're really following closely and reading all sort of the minutia that, you know, we all write, not a lot, but I think he definitely feels like the draft lines up this year for what they need, meaning, you know, they need to get faster and better all over the defense. And I think he feels like, you know, this draft with eight picks, second, third, fourth, fifth round, you know, he's going to, it's a pretty deep defensive draft. He feels like he's going to be able to get guys. You know, they sort of plan things out in a way that, you know, like they always do. I'm sure we've talked about it. They drafted Fowler last year because they didn't think, or they weren't sure there were going to be a lot of great pass rushers at the top. And that, you know, there's some, but it's not just loaded down with it. They'd have a tough time getting one at five. So the percentage planning that they try to do looking ahead, you know, you hope will pay off for them again, because that's going to be key. But beyond that, you know, I just get the vibe talking to Dave and Gus, that they feel like the improvements can be made. Like, you know, sticking with Wash and knowing the system and being able to draft for this system, you know, they feel good about this offseason. I've gotten that vibe from both of them. What else are they going to say? I don't know, but that's the feeling right now.
Out of practice yesterday, the first opportunity to get these guys out there on the field yesterday with the South team. I know we've been talking for the last week, basically, about who we may have our eyes on from position groups, individual players. Noah Spence, a name that comes up a lot. But wanted to talk to you for a moment about the outside linebacker group. Reggie Ragland, a guy who's expected to be a mid-first-round pick, so probably not in the Jaguars' sights. But seeing the other two guys from that position group there with the South team lining up right next to Reggie Ragland, and Jordan Jenkins and Eric Stryker, obviously different types of athletes with those two guys, but all the reports I've seen coming out of day one were that Jordan Jenkins really stood out, that outside linebacker coming out of Georgia.
Yeah, he looked good. I'll be honest with you, I didn't get a chance. We're on Jaguars.com live during that, so I'm upstairs kind of talking. So I wasn't on the field really around scouts and position coaches to hear if they were oohing and aahing. He certainly looked the part from up top on the five or six plays that I really saw him stand out. I thought Spence stood out. I thought the BYU kid, and I can't pronounce his name, and it escaped me right now, but the BYU defensive end was able to get around the edge quite a bit. So the guys that they thought would stand out in the linebacker core, which is a good core this year here, did stand out. I thought Ragland had a couple of plays that made you go, wow. The question on him is, can he play the, you know, well, the outside? Is he more of an interior guy? Probably the latter. But, you know, at this point, the Jaguars need guys who can make plays. So if you can run and hit and catch the ball when it's in the air, I think the Jaguars are going to like you.
Hey, John, what do they have coming up today? I heard Dan Hicken say this morning on the drill, I think that practice got pushed back. What's the weather like up there?
It's raining. It's wet. It's cold. So it's awesome. Yeah, it's but
perfect.
It's definitely, it's my understanding, too, the practice has been pushed back. I'm actually trying to figure out exactly when we're going to go over. So it started to rain on us a little bit during .com Live. And, you know, Mike Duraco was on, so he got the rain a lot later than the rest of us.
I understood.
A little big. We have to explain the joke. It's not as funny. But and I thought yesterday the rain at times might have hurt the offensive lineman a little bit in the one-on-one pass blocking drill. It's kind of tough for those guys to set up and really go. You want to try to protect yourself on that field. You don't want to get hurt over here. That's the saddest thing. You see a guy walking off with a knee. That's not what you're looking for.
No, obviously. For you personally, what do you guys have? An episode of .com Live coming up today. What are you writing about?
I actually caught up with Keenan McCardle yesterday. And I talked to him a lot about the Allen Robinson and Allen Hurns. It was interesting, the connection that he feels with those guys. It's kind of a cool story, because here's a guy who matters very much. Jaguars mean a lot to him, and he's really excited about A-Rob and Hurns, which we all are, but it was kind of neat to see his perspective on that. He's definitely watching them and, you know, thinks he sees a lot of him and Jimmy in those two. So I thought that was neat. It's the kind of thing you get at the Senior Bowl that you don't always get anywhere else, because you see a lot of NFL types walking around. So look for that on Jaguars.com. How's that for a teaser, Mike?
That's a beautiful tease, John, and very cool for Allen Robinson. He won the Vizio Top Value Performer of the Year, a guy whose performance outpaced his pay scale. And so congrats to him for being nominated and then winning that award, and well-deserved on that front as well. John, keep up the good work, and we appreciate the report. We'll hope you stay dry enough, and we'll check in with you tomorrow.
All right, guys. Thank you, Mike. See you.
You got it, buddy. John Osier on Twitter, simply at John Osier. And, of course, you read him at Jaguars.com. Get the latest from his conversation with Keenan McCardell, talking about the Jaguar wide receiver core and where they're headed
in the near
future. Very good stuff. All right, coming up, Tony, we've got this date in football and a very interesting historical perspective on one guy who was born on this particular date, not named Fred Taylor. Happy 40th to Freddie T. This date in football, the Honda driver on the NFL, and more coming your way in moments. This is Jaguars Today on a Metro Rooter Wednesday on 1010XL and 92.5 FM.
Now, Jaguars Today on 1010XL, 92.5 FM. And now, this date in football history.
All right, this date in football history, it is January 27th, 1991. Tony, you enjoyed this one. The Buffalo Bills fell to the New York Giants 20-19 in Tampa. Super Bowl MVP that year, your boy Otis O.J. Anderson.
Yes.
You call him Otis, you call him O.J.?
I've always called him Otis.
I have too. People do call him O.J. Anderson. 2001, NFL Hall of Fame inducted 7 in the 2001 class. Nick Bonacani, Marv Levy, Mike Munchak, Jackie Slater, Lynn Swan, Ron Yeary, and Jack Youngblood, whose birthday was yesterday, all went in. So that was a nice birthday present for Jack Youngblood.
Sure.
Back in 2001. Famous birthdays for this date. I'll start with Art Rooney, born in this date in 1901, longtime owner of the Pittsburgh Steelers. Obviously, the Steelers still in the hands of the Rooney Mara clan. 1959, Chris Collinsworth from Titusville Astronaut High School, wide receiver for your Florida Gators and your Cincinnati Bengals, turns 57 years old today, a three-time Pro Bowler. And Freddie T, we've been talking about a lot today, turning 40. The guy I didn't mention, I saved the most important, the most significant for last, born in this date in 1894, gentleman by the name of Fritz Pollard. He is an NFL Hall of Fame inductee who played in the 1920s. Like most of those guys, you probably may not have heard of him. Maybe that name sounds vaguely familiar to you. However, the Fritz Pollard Alliance is the organization that has been instrumental in getting the rule passed that compels teams hiring a head coach to interview a minority in the process. Not to hire them, but to interview them in the process for a head coaching position. And, some talk they'd like to see it expanded out to coordinator-level positions. Fritz Pollard played in the National Football League, Tony, in its very first year, 1920, was part of the Akron Pros team, and he won an NFL championship in his very first year. A black player. There were several other black players in the 1920s. Fritz Pollard became an NFL head coach as a player coach in 1921. Second year the NFL was in existence, Fritz Pollard was a head coach. Probably not many people realize that. A lot of people think of Art Shell, but that's the modern NFL. What happened was, along the way, in 1933, the owner of the Redskins, whose name escapes me at the moment, but I'll dig it up here in a second. The owner of the Redskins basically helped to unofficially segregate the National Football League. It had been an integrated league, and as it became more popular, he felt it wouldn't be as appealing to white patrons, all these black players running around making plays on the football field. So it was not an official policy of the National Football League, but there were no black players from 1933 until 1946, and in fact, the Redskins stayed segregated until 1962 when the Kennedy administration apparently threatened the Redskins, said, you're not going to be able to play in the nation's capital if you don't do something about this sorry state of affairs on your football team. And so they grudgingly then opted to integrate the Washington Redskins. So there you have it. Fritz Pollard, next time you hear about the Fritz Pollard Alliance, you'll know where that comes from. An NFL Hall of Fame player. As well as a pioneer in the National Football League and the first black coach in the National Football League, born in this date way back in 1894. That is this date in football history.
Now the Honda Drive around the NFL, brought to you by your First Coast Honda dealers.
New England Patriots linebacker Jerod Mayo was placed on IR before the AFC Championship game last weekend and had surgery to repair a torn pectoral muscle. He is expected to be ready to go by training camp for the Pats. Fox's Mike Garofalo reported yesterday that the NFL has requested an interview with Peyton Manning to discuss the allegations made by Al Jazeera regarding Manning and potential HGH use, but that the interview isn't expected to happen until after the Super Bowl at some point. Major League Baseball has already begun an investigation in tandem with the United States Anti-Doping Agency to look into Al Jazeera's claims. The NFL, as it usually does, is choosing to handle this investigation independently. Former New York Giants safety Tyler Sash, who played just 2 years in the NFL and walked away from the game at the age of 24, recently died from an accidental overdose of painkillers. Sash's family donated his brain to be studied for CTE. According to a report in the New York Times yesterday, quote, representatives from Boston University and the Concussion Legacy Foundation notified the Sash family that CTE had been diagnosed in Tyler's brain and that the disease, which can only be confirmed posthumously, had advanced to a stage rarely seen in someone that age. The article went on to describe the stages, basically, of CTE from 0 to 4. Sash, even at just age 27, was already stage 2, which was the same stage as Junior Seau when he took his own life.
You don't know, you know, and because they can't diagnose this at the present time until after death.
Right.
It's impossible to know exactly, you know, how predisposed you may be to this. They don't understand all these things. You know, here's a guy, Tony, like you said, played a couple of years. He's 27, should not have this degree, you wouldn't think, of cumulative brain trauma, but apparently he did. Now, that doesn't mean he couldn't have been in a lot of head-on collisions or has suffered some significant concussions of his own along the way. It's a scary time,
sure,
though.
By the time you get to the NFL, most of these guys have been playing football for 10, 15 years
and
already.
Taking shots.
Right. I mean, it's not like the NFL is where you start getting hit.
Exactly. You see it a little bit more. It's better regulated. You know, you look at peewee football and – or whatever you want to call it, you know, whatever age. I see these kids, and we're out practicing soccer. I see a lot of these kids out in St. Augustine practicing football. And for some of the part, the danger is taken out because these kids, when the pads are on, they're like the Michelin Man. You know what I mean? They're like this tiny body inside this well-protected suit. Now, that's not to say that the head doesn't bounce against the skull if you get a headshot, but the point is these guys at that age are not able to deliver as many vicious blows. You can still get a concussion. You could fall down and hit your head,
sure,
on the curb and get a concussion. There are lots of ways to do it. So there is some, you know, hey, the brain's not fully developed at that stage, but I think the risk is, some believe, is somewhat lessened because the kind of impacts you're taking obviously are not nearly as significant as you go along will be. George Preston Marshall, by the way, was the Redskins owner who was described as an influential leader in helping to unofficially impose a color line back in the National Football League, or for the first time, because the NFL didn't have one when they started play in 1920. Black players, come on down. You can play? You can play. You want to be a coach? All right, if you can coach, you can coach. And then George Preston Marshall set back the NFL and that aspect of sporting society at least for 13 years and beyond that, because by the time, Tony, it wasn't like it was rosters were 50% African-American, 50% white, or anything close to that,
sure,
back in the 20s. But by the time, if it had gone along at a normal progression, by the time 1946 rolled around, or 1962 when the Washington Redskins finally reintegrated, who knows? You know, it would have been probably a lot more like the makeup it is today. Maybe not quite to the degree it is today, because there was still a lot of roadblocks, you know, socially and culturally. But for these guys, the door was open to begin with, and then they had it slammed in their face after 13 years. It's kind of crazy.
Yeah, it really is. And George Preston Marshall.
Yes.
Outside of James Earl Jones, is there anybody who uses all three names that you can trust? You get the three. Like, if you start getting the third name,
I've seen conspiracy theory.
It's usually, okay, a bad sign.
Right. And then they're like,
all the assassins,
like,
always
have
three
Sirhan,
names.
What about Sirhan?
Yeah.
and then they get all confused. You're right. Mark David Chapman. Is it? Do we really did Mark David Chapman go by Mark David Chapman, or did we just want to distinguish him between some other innocent Mark Chapman?
That's what I'm saying. When you start getting the third name.
Yeah, right. You're right. It's just applied to you.
Yeah.
Like, I'm just Mike Dempsey now. I'd be Michael Robert Dempsey if I did something infamous enough.
Sounds sophisticated.
Thank you very much. Very long story how I got it. They gave me my dad's name as my middle name and my grandfather's name as my
first name. He always wanted to go by Robbie.
Yes.
It drove him crazy.
My father went by Bertie, by the way, at least to the Irish side of the family.
Tony, since you are a member of the Witness Protection Program, what is your middle name?
My full name is Anthony Armstrong Smith.
The A is actually for anonymous. Anthony Anonymous Smith. Anthony Armstrong.
Named after my great-grandfather, still one of my favorite names of all time. His name was Armstrong Jones. That is such a strong name.
That's a pretty strong name.
Yeah.
What's your name, Armstrong Jones? No, really, what's your name? A cartoon? Tyler Devitt, let's guess. Tyler.
Oh, you won't guess this one.
Give us a letter, please.
Aloysius.
F.
I knew an Aloysius in college. F. Tyler F. Devitt.
Frederick.
TFD.
Very close. Kind of close.
Friedrich.
No, it is Francis.
That's not that close.
Francis.
Francis.
Frederick Francis. Very close there. But yeah, it was named
Francis
after my grandfather.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, Francis with an I.
Lighten up, Francis.
Either that or he's named after my maternal grandmother.
Apparently, my mom
had that reference and he doesn't even know what it is. I guarantee you.
Lighten up Francis? Never heard of Lighten Up Francis?
I don't get that reference at all.
Okay, then.
Yeah. Apparently, I was very close to being Francis as my first name. Thank God my mom stuck up for that one.
What are you trying to say to Frank Frangie? Huh?
Nothing.
Like
I love Frank.
Francis?
Frank is a radio legend.
And by the way, Frank is not a Francis.
Is he not? No.
He's just a Frank. They went straight to the shortening of it.
No messing around.
Almost named Pete.
You were almost named Pete?
Yeah. My parents.
Peter or Pete?
Like Pete, after Pete Rose. Like, it was my parents' favorite.
His name was Peter.
Yeah, but I was almost named Pete, which. Thank God.
The program almost gave you the name Pete.
You would have had to have the haircut, too.
Yeah, I don't need that.
We should bet a haircut. We should have a haircut bet. Tony and I on something because I want to see you with a Pete Rose bowl cut.
Ugh.
That'd be tremendous. I don't think your hair would do the Pete Rose bowl cut as well. Mine would probably do it if I grew it out a little bit. Remember when we did the show back on another network? It was me, Hacker, Travis Newsom, and Brent Beard, right? And I don't know what the contest was we're trying to give away. There are only like 16 combinations you can come up with for this. And we gave you all, the four people.
Mm-hmm.
And we gave you the middle names, and you had to call. And one of them didn't have a middle name. I believe it's Brent. Does not have a middle name. Brent Beard, no middle name. He's just Brent Beard.
What the heck is that?
I don't know, but it's probably a communist plot. But we did that, and honestly, you would think after anyone who's paying attention, after 2 or 3 minutes, would by process of elimination narrow it down on what it had to be, and it went on and on. And on. Great radio back then. Guess our middle names. Hey, it was
Mike Dempsey, man. I mean, that's a sweet name.
That's what I'm talking about right there.
What is that from? Nate Newton saying Mike Dempsey. That's a sweet name. How do we have that?
We had Nate Newton on at the Super Bowl in Dallas, right? He was Stephen Gribben was our golf guy for years. He used to be an ESPN golf guy. And still does a great job. He's a broadcaster out in Dallas, covers the PGA Tour, among other things. And when we went to the Super Bowl in Dallas during the ice storm, we stayed at Gribben's house, and Donna Murphy had to be the designated driver driving in to wherever they were holding it at the convention center. Mm-hmm. Like we drove by Dealey Plaza in that area every day. It was very cool, but the roads were covered with black ice. Anyway, Nate Newton was really good personal friends with Gribben, and Nate Newton, when he played, Tyler was like, 350. Right? He was enormous, right? And we saw, Gribben goes, I want to introduce you to somebody. And Nate Newton had a stomach bypass surgery. You would have sat there for a million years. And even if you said former NFL player, you never would have guessed it was Nate Newton because the guy was like a buck 80 or whatever it was. And so I guess it was from that. I didn't even know we had that.
Mike Dempsey, man. I mean, that's a sweet name.
Nate Newton, that's a sweet name, too. That's what they thought when they caught you with 300 pounds of pot in your car.
Woof.
Or whatever it was back in the day. That's for personal use, officer.
It was on the way to the White House, I'm sure.
I'm sure it was.
Over there in Dallas.
I'm sure it was. All right. So coming up next, we've got the author of a retrospective look at the Super Bowl. Super Bowl 50, celebrating 50 years of America's greatest game. Bethany Bradshaw put it together. We'll talk to her about that coming up next. And by the way, we're getting some copies of the book. Hardcover goes for $34, Tony. Pretty pricey. $33.93 is suggested price on Amazon right now. But a copy of that will go in the Super Bowl swag bag. Again, if you want to get in the Super Bowl contest, tell us which team wins and make a prediction on something that will occur during the game. And if you get them both right, you're eligible. You're in the running for the Super Bowl swag bag. And we'll determine the winner of that when we get back from San Francisco. With Fat Tony, I'm Mike Dempsey. It is a Metro Rooter Wednesday live at Everbank on 1010XL and 92.5 FM.
Welcome our next guest to the Metro Diner Chat Counter.
These are delicious.
On 1010XL, Metro Diner, where the locals eat.
All right, Super Bowl 50, I'll be honest, before we know it, they're not calling it Super Bowl L, Tony. They shelved the Roman numerals for a year because they don't want everyone referred to as losers out there. The L. They didn't like the way it looked in the graphics. They went with the 50. They went with the Arabic numerals. They will be switching back. Officially, next year will be Super Bowl LI, says the National Football League. Mike Dempsey, Fat Tony here
with you. Losers International.
Hey, could be. Absolutely. Unless the Jags are in it, all right? And then it's just winners, baby. All right? The author of a new book is with us, Bethany Bradshaw. The book is Super Bowl 50, Celebrating 50 Years of America's Greatest Game. I say a new book. It's been out since the fall. But Bethany joins us here on 1010XL. Good morning, Bethany. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing great. Thank you for letting me come on.
You're very welcome. And we're interested in the book, obviously, with the Super Bowl coming up. We're interested in what you learned in compiling some of the stories for the book. But let me ask you this first. Why did you feel this was a subject you wanted to broach?
Well, I was asked to be part of a team that was putting this together, and I jumped at the chance. I mean, because this game is such an epic national event. That, you know, what has been really fun for me, I'm kind of into trends and, you know, a little bit of a historian, and just to watch the growth of both professional football, the growth of this game, you know, really going from kind of just a big football game to a national spectacle that even those who really hate football have to pay attention to, because there's so many cultural, you know, touch points along the way. So it was really fun to kind of look at all the aspects of the game, not just on the football field, but everything from commercials to halftime shows to gambling, and you know, there's all these ways that this game, you can't ignore it. Even if you wish you could, you really can't.
So what is the book? I know it's more than just the collection of the scores and box scores from the first 49 Super Bowls. So what will people find when they get this book?
Well, we do cover each of the 49 games that's been played to this point, but so much more. And it was a ton of fun to put those stories together, because there have obviously been some great games and some games that weren't so great along the way. But we talk about all those and then really focus on the people of the Super Bowl. So top players, top coaches, best players to never win a Super Bowl gets a little bit of play there. You know, we even have a section, page 206, is the Jaguars, teams that haven't made it to a Super Bowl yet. So
yet,
you get a little
yet.
Bit of space there.
That's right. Yet.
Yet, exactly. Well, I mean, you're in a good position when you compare yourself to Detroit and Cleveland.
This is true.
So
they've been around
the number
a lot
of years
longer.
They've been around. Exactly right. So there's
they've
do
had
not
more
fret.
Shots at it. They've had
yeah,
50
so
cracks at it.
They have had, and even, yeah, quite a few. So that's a lot of fun just to look at the people that made the game great. And then we look at all the off-the-field aspects. So, you know, we even talk about Super Bowl parties and what kind of dip people like to serve, you know, that kind of thing. And a whole section on halftime shows, national anthems, the commercials, and how that became really something that everybody's talking about before and after the game. You know, it went from, it used to be in the first 25 years, really, companies didn't produce ads for the Super Bowl. They just played the same ones they had already. And that really changed, particularly in about 1984 when Apple put out a kind of a weird dystopian commercial that was based on the George Orwell book.
Sure.
And it wasn't even that great, but it got people talking, and it was produced for the Super Bowl, and that really turned the tide. And from that time on, of course, companies pour all kinds of untold dollars into producing these pieces, and now we're up to $5 million for a 30-second spot.
Yeah, it is. Those are the kind of things to me that are a little bit more interesting. I'm looking forward to reading in this book because we know so much about the history of the big plays and the games and the players that were in it. Some of these side elements are very interesting. That Apple commercial, if I'm correct in this, Bethany, only ran once in its entirety as an actual commercial. I think they shortened it down to like a 30-second version where they were, you know, swinging the hammer and they broke the screen and everybody
the screen.
Was...
Yeah, it was weird.
Right. It was weird, but it was eye-catching at the time.
It was.
And, you know, the whole 1984 theme was pretty big with that as well. Tony and I sat here, I don't know, a month and a half ago, and when they were talking about who was going to perform with Coldplay coming in to do the halftime show this year, and we looked back at the history of halftime performers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when I grew up, I distinctly remember that group Up With People.
I'm so sorry that you remember that.
I know.
That's pretty painful. Yeah.
Here's my question. How did it go from, like, the Florida A&M marching band and Up With People and groups like that to go from that to a stage for the biggest, most high-profile musical acts, some of them of all time? How did that switch occur?
Well, the sea change there, the real pivotal year was 1993, and that was that Michael Jackson show that, if I say it, people are going to remember what he had on. You know, it was the military jacket with the gold and the white glove, and, you know, it was very iconic. He was at the height of his, you know, talent and power as a pop star, and he put on a great show. And so that was the beginning. You know, New Kids on the Block was kind of the first pop group to perform, and that was 2 years earlier. But they didn't quite move the needle the way Michael Jackson did. And so from that time on, you know, those that produced for the NFL, that produced the halftime show, realized, hey, this is something else entirely. And the Michael Jackson year was the first year that ratings went up for halftime. So, you know, before that, people would go walk the dog, you know, make a snack run. It was really not viewed the way it is now. And you remember that In Living Color, and that was around that time, had their own kind of show during halftime.
I do remember that, yes.
Yeah, so they were trying to compete, and they could do it because it just wasn't as big of a deal. But it's really interesting just to look back. You know, there was a guy, Jim Steig, who's out in San Diego now, and he was kind of called the Super Bowl czar. And he was the guy that really is responsible for creating this, you know, hoopla that surrounded the game, and especially at where the halftime show is concerned. And yeah, you know, you look at wardrobe malfunctions and things that are part of our American vocabulary because of the Super Bowl halftime and realize that it's pretty huge.
Yeah, and the gambling that goes on around the Super Bowl, too. I know here in about a week we'll get an opportunity to look at some of these prop bets that come up, and it'll be anything from how long the halftime show is going to be. You may be able to gamble on what songs they're going to play. You can gamble on how long the anthem before the game will actually be. It's crazy how in-depth it gets for this specific game every year.
Absolutely. Will Bruno Mars wear a hat? That was a prop bet. And the year that Bruno Mars did the halftime show. So, you know, yeah, and you just don't ever know what Vegas is going to come up with, and people will jump on board. So that's another area where it just is so much bigger than the game itself, because you, again, don't even have to like football now to be part of the betting action, and people do jump in and wager a whole lot of money on some of the craziest stuff. Coin flips, you know, everything.
Yeah. I'm surprised, no, because when they rehearse – the national anthem. I mean, they rehearse it, I assume, the way they're going to do it. And then they put an over-under on it. Right? I'm surprised somebody who is in one of those rehearsals doesn't get word to a friend that, hey, she's hitting the 210 mark consistently here. Play the under on 212. You know what I mean? Like, somebody hasn't really, really put some big money down on that. Maybe they have. I don't know.
Maybe, but then someone is in Idina Menzel's pocket going, just throw a couple of runs in there, you know.
Right, exactly.
Run, you know?
Hey, let's go over, Adele.
And then it's over, and then, it just throws off. I mean, just to have that kind of power, that's pretty awesome.
All right, so tell us what, as you went in this book, I'm sure, you know, you don't undertake this endeavor unless you're somewhat of a sports fan, so probably not everything you found out in your research surprised you, but tell us something that you didn't know prior to writing the book that you really found very interesting.
Well, I think it really kind of covers that idea that the first 20 or 25 years were just nothing like the Super Bowl we see now. And that isn't to say that no one paid attention to it. That would be false. But it was really something for football fans. And just to see the way it's grown and taken on a life of its own. And so, you know, I didn't know that a third of the stadium at Los Angeles Coliseum was empty for Super Bowl I. You know, that was something I learned. And that two networks recorded that game, but they erased the tapes. They taped over them. Remember VCR days when you needed some tape for something else? So there is no tape footage from those games because they recorded over it. So that goes a long way to show how it was regarded at the time, historically.
Isn't that insane?
Like,
I mean,
isn't
just,
that crazy? Yeah.
They've done that with some of the, like, the moon landing tapes, too. The original moon landing tape. It's like, how? What in the world, people? A little perspective, right?
Hello. Like, what did you have to record, you know, Barney Miller over the, you know, I don't know.
Barney Miller was
back
good
then,
back in the day.
I did that for Abe Vigoda. That was an Abe Vigoda tribute.
That's a good point.
So there you go. But, yeah, it's just really so neat to me the way it's changed. And, you know, some people may say it's just excessive, but we're Americans and we do excess better than anybody. So that the way the game grew, and I like to watch the trends in football as well, just the way kind of defense ruled in the 70s with the Steel Curtain and the Steelers, and then you got, you know, the West Coast offense with the 49ers coming in the 80s, and that kind of thing is fun because you can really look at one game a year and see how the game of football has evolved over that time.
What happened? I mean, 20, 25 years in, when it went from just being the Super Bowl to kind of turning into this cultural phenomenon, is there anything that happened in that time? What triggered that?
I think it's these peripheral things that we're talking about. So, you know, when the halftime show became a big pop star phenomenon and the commercials became something you didn't leave your couch for, you know, kind of 80s, late 80s, early 90s, then people started to have Super Bowl parties because that was something you could do even if you didn't like football. There were all these other things to pay attention to, and it was water cooler conversation. And so that's when the shift happened, I think. It's just because everything around the game really grew in importance and stature.
How big was the 85 Bears in the process of moving it forward as well? You know, they did the Super Bowl shuffle, which was, you know, kind of a weird oddity at the time that had some crossover appeal, and they were seen, you know, in a major market, one of the arguably greatest teams of all time, certainly maybe one of the best defenses of all time. Was that any kind of a pivotal game in terms of moving the needle at all?
I think it was. And then Jim McMahon on his own, you know, he was just this kind of media zeitgeist. I mean, he was so crazy during that time. And there were like women, that were protesting him and angry with him. I mean, there was all kinds of stuff going on with him alone. So, yeah, that was the kind of team and the kind of media personalities that really helped elevate the game.
All right. Bethany Bradshaw is the author of Super Bowl 50. Celebrating 50 years of America's greatest game, looking back at the history of the Super Bowl from every angle possible. I know the book's been out for a while. How's it doing?
Oh, very well. It's been so much fun just to hear people's responses and to really get the word out all over the country. SuperBowl50book.com, there's my plug if you would like to order the book.
Perfect.
Or learn more about it. There's all kinds of information there. You can get a sneak peek and get yourself a copy. But it has been a ton of fun just to be part of helping to celebrate this game. And we're excited about, you know, February 7th.
Are you making the trip out to San Francisco to talk about the book?
Unfortunately, I don't think so. I had really hoped I was. And I actually live in North Carolina, and I covered the Panthers in their first two seasons. So,
wow.
I've kind of come full circle from being a beat writer for the Panthers to now writing this book and having them play in it. So I guess the one consolation of not going to San Francisco is I'll be right here in the state where people are going bananas for this team. So it'll be fun.
I would imagine that'll be a lot of fun. And I can't wait to see that next year right here in Jacksonville when we do the same. So and
sounds great.
Run of 10 in a row. Unprecedented,
I'll be there.
Bethany. All right, Bethany, we appreciate it. Continued success with the book, and we appreciate the time this morning.
Absolutely, no problem. Thank you for having me.
All right, you got it. SuperBowl50book.com, Tony, if you want to check that out. We've got some copies on the way. And, again, we'll throw one of those copies in the Super Bowl swag bag. It's the first official thing. A lot of garbage goes in the Super Bowl swag bag, by the way. There's a lot of cheap claptrap that you're going to throw away.
This is not one of those things.
This will be a good, will be a nice piece that's in that book. And again, for folks who only maybe caught part of it earlier, if you want to enter the Super Bowl contest, it's open for business beginning today, right up until kickoff of the game. But you can only enter it by emailing me at MikeD@1010XL.com. Tell us who wins the game, which team wins the game, and make a prediction on something that will happen during the game. You've got to get both parts right. The game prediction and your prediction of what happens during the game, and then we collect all the correct entries or both right on both scores, and then we determine which of the entries or the predictions that came true was the least likely to have come true, and that will be the winner of the Super Bowl swag bag. All decisions by the panel are
final unless we decide to change our mind. So there you have it. We go back to Mobile. The Road Scout will join us next. Dan Hicken, live in Mobile, courtesy of our friends at Dandy Sandwiches. That's coming up next on a Metro Rooter Wednesday here on Jaguars Today on 1010XL and 92.5 FM. All right, here we go. Brought to you by Dandy Sandwiches, our good friends here in Jacksonville. They travel well all the way to Mobile, like Dan Hicken, the Road Scout, baby. Don't forget where that moniker came from. Well, it came from me, but it really came from his grueling work, Tony, that Dan does on the road, putting eyeballs on prospects on a yearly basis. You see him here as part of the CBS 47 Fox 30 team of broadcasters. You hear him on 1010XL. What you don't realize is pretty much every waking moment when he's off the air, he is scouting prospects for the NFL draft and for your Jacksonville Jaguars. And this week is a continuation of that process. Hello, Dan Hicken. How are you?
It's true. It's true. But the nickname lends so much credibility to my efforts here. And I
well,
do
it does.
Appreciate
You're,
it.
You are the Road Scout. The Road Scout. And when you walk into Mobile and it's time for Beers with Belly, is
yeah.
they know you don't have Beers with Belly without the Road Scout. So it's
well,
nice
you
got
to be the Road Scout. Clearly, Belly wanted to have me along last night, so that was quite a thrill.
Hey, the guy wants to make sure he's not losing his fastball. He wants a new set of eyes, fresh set of eyes. To
I give Belly credit, by the way. I mean, what about that guy getting right down here to work on next year? Holy cow.
Hey, you know what? He and Nick say he probably had more days off than he had wanted, obviously. Probably took one day off, and I would imagine he got down there. What is going on right now, Hick? I mean, I guess weather delay today, but
yeah.
You got to see some of the South practice yesterday. I heard you on a couple of your hits this morning on the drill, and you said
right.
Really your focus is on the defensive side of the ball, obviously, right now.
Well, I just thought that's where, you know, the Jags are looking, and I asked Gus about it, and he laughed and said, you were watching me, and yeah, we were, and you know, look, it's no secret what the Jaguars need to do, and it'll be interesting to see, you know, how much what Denver and Carolina, to that matter, and their accomplishments. You guys know the NFL is a copycat league, and I think if we go back over the last 10 Super Bowls, the better defense usually wins over the better offense. So, you know, clearly they're looking for pass rushers. We talked to Dave Caldwell about that yesterday, and you know that. You know, there's so much on Dante Fowler Jr., but the reality is he's a rookie, and rookie defensive ends don't pile up sack numbers. They just don't, not even the great ones. So I wouldn't be surprised at all if they add through free agency and could also draft another. I mean, as Dave said, you can never have enough pass rushers is something I think everybody kind of understands and what you search for in this game of football.
Yeah, looking at the defensive side of the ball there for the South team, especially the pass rushers that could be available to the Jaguars when it comes draft time. Probably not looking at anything at number five with these guys, but potentially second,
guys,
third,
right,
fourth, fifth
right.
round. What did right. stand out for you?
Well, I mean, everybody, you know, watched the Alabama kids are good. Obviously, there's a reason why they won the national title, and it wasn't necessarily because of their quarterback or. You know, so the Reed kid is looked really good. I like Sheldon Rankins from Louisville. Now he's an inside guy. I don't know how much of a pass rusher he is, but he to me looks like, you know, if you were going to compare him to somebody, maybe. And this is way lofty praise, so don't get me wrong. I'm not saying he's the next Aaron Donald, but he has kind of that build, and he's a little bit bigger than him. But he was quick. So. I thought he had some moves. Noah Spence is everything everybody said. I don't know his off-field story. He's comparatively speaking, when he stands next to some of these guys, a smaller, but he's fast, and he gets around the edge quick. I like the linemen. I like the linebackers. Those are the guys I watched mostly yesterday. The Oakman kid was not – he's the Baylor Adonis, if you will, who – you know, I heard Todd Wash numerous times tell him to get the pads down. You know, I mean, he just is so tall and upright and is chiseled, but I don't know how effective he'll be in the league. It'll be interesting to see what he's able to do. Somebody will draft him because, you know, these guys got that ego and they're convinced that they can coach him right and get him right. So somebody will draft him based on potential alone, I would assume.
Yeah, let me get my hands on him, and we'll turn him into a play.
Right. You know how it is.
Thing. Oh, absolutely.
I always remember that Tom Coughlin phone call when he drafted R.J. Soward, and Tom talking to R.J. really in a harsh tone. I mean, you know, we're not going to have that, you know, stuff around here, right? You know, and I mean, just, you know, I mean, they knew, but they were willing to run the risk. They wanted those three wide receivers, and why would you blame them? I mean, you know, if he could have developed, that would have been an unbelievable passing attack. But I always think about that when I think about guys who want to take chances on kids, and you just never know.
It is funny, though, and it's just an extension of that. The coaches think that, hey, when I get my hands on him, and whether it's an off-the-field issue, whether it's a lack of fulfilling their potential, whatever the case, Dan, as you well know, Jerry Sullivan will tell you, none of these players have been coached properly. And you know how I know that? None of the rookies? Because they haven't been coached by me yet. That's basically how he feels about coaching wide receivers.
Sure.
I don't care how they were taught to run routes in college. I'm going to teach them the right way to do it. And so there's probably a lot of that going around in the NFL.
Yeah, I would think so. I would think so. It'll be, I think there's some players here that they like, and I'm talking to Gus a little bit later today, and I'll try to see what's going on as he gets ready to go to South practice. I failed to mention, and I'm sure you guys have talked about it, though, the weather here is not great, very raw,
right.
Cold outside, but the rain was all-night rain, raining this morning, seems to have slowed down, so I think they've tried to shift the practices. Well, they have shifted them, so the North will go at noon our time, which is 1 o'clock your time, so... and the South would go a couple hours after that. So a little bit later today than normal.
Hey, Dan, let me wrap up with this. Dave Caldwell talking yesterday about the impact he hopes to get out of Dante Fowler Jr. and a full return to health from Cinderic Marks, which he expects. He thinks these injuries were isolated things and that he should be fine by the start of the season. When you look at defensive tackle on this team, I think a lot of people say, okay, you know what? If Marks comes back, they've got Roy Miller. They've got Tyson Alualu and Odrick who can play in there on a part-time basis. Avery Jones is a restricted free agent, so if they want him back, they'll have him back. They've got Michael Bennett from last year. Do they have enough at defensive tackle, or is there room to maybe add a guy with a draft pick, particularly a guy more in the vein of a Cinderic Marks, a penetrator who can create a little havoc?
I would definitely go the latter. I mean, look, we can name the names, and you know, it's funny, when we talk about them individually, we always say, oh, he's doing good, or he's doing, you know. But collectively, you know, they're one of the worst defenses in the NFL. So if you find a guy who's better than the guys you got, you go get that guy. If you can find somebody to come in and be it Sample, or you get a guy who you think's better than both Cyprian and Sample, you know, you get that guy, right? I mean, look, it's a harsh business, but as you both know, the game is on. I mean, there are no more excuses. This is a team that, you know, must take that next step, and you better leave no stone unturned this offseason and find the right guys and get the right chemistry and get playmakers on both sides of the ball. So in a long-winded answer to your question, I would say, yeah, I think you can find, and if you do find, I would take one in. I wouldn't be afraid to take one in round 3 or round 4, even round 2, if you're convinced that guy can start or is better than Miller, or you're not sold on, you know. I mean, Cinderic isn't a spring chicken anymore either. And while they're two separate injuries, they are injuries. So,
right.
You know, you have to take that into account, I would think.
All right, Hick, it's Fred Taylor's 40th birthday. If that doesn't make you feel old, I don't know what
will today. Oh, Freddie T.
Right? It's all over, Fred. Your single favorite memory of Fred Taylor in a Jaguar uniform. I can imagine you have some 1997-related favorite memories as a Gator. But in a Jaguar uniform, Freddie T's favorite memory for Dan Hicken is what?
Oh, gosh. There's so many. But, you know, I always love Sexton's 90-yard call.
Right.
So that sticks out in my mind always. And there was a game early, and I don't know if it was the preseason or regular season. You guys may know. And it was against Kansas City. And Freddie T went up the middle and ran over somebody and then kicked it outside and outran guys. And 225, 230-pound running backs just don't do that. And that's where you thought, man, this guy is special. And I think he was special to Tom Coughlin, by the way. This is a a Jaguar moment, too, when he took that shirt off at the Florida workout in Gainesville and blazed that 40, and everybody went, whoa. So I think those are my memories of Freddie.
He could truck you and outrun you on the very same play.
There's very few who can do that. Very few in the league, even in any year. It's tough to find those guys.
That's why the road scout whispered in TC's ear, this is our guy. Make it happen, Tommy.
Thank you, boy.
The road scout. All right, Dan. We appreciate it, buddy. We'll talk to you later on in the week, all right?
Okay, thank you.
There he goes, Dan Hicken, live from Mobile, courtesy of Dandy Sandwiches.
I'm pretty sure that Kansas City game was in his rookie year, and I want to say it was one of the first couple weeks of the year. He didn't get a ton of carries his first couple games in a Jags uniform.
Second game, Tony.
Was it?
Second game they played Kansas City.
And then it felt like after that he got a ton of work.
Right. He had 6 for 44 in that game. And then against Baltimore, he broke the long one, and it was off to the races for Fred Taylor after that with his first 100-yard game the next week against the Ravens, 23 for 128, going back to his rookie season. Freddie T, happy birthday. We asked people today what their favorite memory of Fred Taylor in a Jaguar uniform was. What kind of sampling did we get today?
Just a couple here from Eric. He said running over Mike Dawson looking back was awesome to see. From Jarrell, the run at Tennessee that gave him 10,000 yards for his career where he trucked a guy. I was actually at that game. That was kind of cool to be there for that moment for Fred Taylor. Of course, we had the 90-yard run mentioned against Miami. We had the game here against the Indianapolis Colts when he and Mojo just destroyed that football team. And Pittsburgh got mentioned quite a bit as well, that 234-yard game he had against them.
By the way, happy birthday to Daniel Stewart, who says, now I know I'm a birthday buddy with the great Freddie T. And his favorite memory is the 90-yard run. Jeff Cummings gave a little bit more detail on, I said, you know, the first couple games he only had 40-something yards. And then while James Stewart had played well, he got hurt. And then Fred came in, first carry, went 52 yards for a touchdown. And as Jeff tells it, one replay angle is he's just across the line of scrimmage, and Brunell's in the background signaling touchdown. I mean, not across the goal line, across the line of scrimmage,
right,
with another 50 to go because they knew what they had in that guy. A lot of votes for the 90 yards in the Pittsburgh game, trucking Mike Doss and many others. Fred, a part of that 334 they put up on the Colts?
I want to say,
Something in that ballpark with Fred and Mojo just absolutely running roughshod. Did Alvin Pearman, like, have 100 yards in that game? I mean, that game was insane. And then that Colts run defense turned it around when they got Bob Sanders back, and that's the one year Peyton Manning won the Super Bowl.
They shut down Larry Johnson.
I mean, it was unbelievable.
Yeah, it was crazy.
Unbelievable. All right, that does it for us today. Happy birthday, Freddie T. Thanks to, John Osier for joining us today. Thanks to Bethany Branster, the author of the new book on Super Bowl, the 50 years of the Super Bowl, which you can get at SuperBowl50book.com, or perhaps you'll win one in the Super Bowl swag bag. Thanks to Dan Hicken, the Road Scout, for joining us today as well. Ryan O'Halloran in tomorrow. Hayes Carline will join us live from Mobile. It'll be a Florida Times Union kind of day on Jaguars today. Thanks to our friends at Metro Rooter, always bringing you the show every Wednesday here on 1010XL and 92.5 FM for all size plumbing jobs. The one call you need to make is to 695-1911, metrorooter.com online. Metro Rooter, our Wednesday sponsor of Jaguars today. For Fat Tony, for Tyler Devitt, for Joe Fortunato, and all of our guests today, I'm Mike Dempsey. Signing off, XL Primetime is next on 1010XL.